Health and Social Services Committee will come to order. It is now 3:32 p.m. on Tuesday, January 24th. We're in the Capitol Room 102. Members present include Representative Eastman, Representative Keita, Representative Sullivan Leonard, myself, Representative Tarr, Representative Johnston, and we are also joined by Finance Committee members, Representative Guerra and Representative Tilton. In the room, I believe we have Representative Sadler. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take a moment to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting, and please turn them all the way off. No vibrate. It's very distracting, and it interferes with our recording system. Before we begin, I would like to thank Butch Carber, who is the House Hess Secretary for our records, and Alex B.B. Judiche. All right. From the Juno LIO for staffing the committee. Representative Edgman has joined us in the room. And then now I will turn the gavel over to Representative Guerra in order for him to facilitate the budgetary overview of the Department of Health and Social Services.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go through some of the rules on how the budget subcommittee will work. We're going to try and keep this as open as possible. While in the past and currently the Mason's rules don't apply, we're going to try and adhere to them as closely as we can, but also keep the meetings as informal as we can at the same time. So this is the first meeting of the Health and Social Services Budget Subcommittee. Welcome, members. We'll all be working together on this budget. The goal of the subcommittee is to make recommendations to the full Finance Committee. They can accept them, they can reject them, but we're going to present them. My intention is also to accept amendments at closeout and to also forward amendments, whether they pass or whether they fail, to the full Finance Committee so that members can take a look at the work of the members of this subcommittee and see if there's something they want to follow up on. And I would encourage you to work with other finance members, too, on issues that are important to you. The main focus of the subcommittee is going to be looking at whole programs. You know, the legislature has sort of nickeled and dimed and looked for 3% cuts across the board, 2% cuts across the board. We're at a budget that's about $3 billion less than it was a number of years ago. And at this point, the focus should be on whether or not there are programs that we still need that aren't working, that aren't serving a constituency very well, programs that could be working better if we do need them. So we're going to try and look at whole programs as much as we can in the committee. And if members have recommendations on programs that they feel aren't serving their purpose anymore, aren't needed, or that could be improved, we should all talk about them. One other goal of the subcommittee, and this has been one of the reasons Representative Seaton, Chair Seaton, has come up with sort of a new process, is he wants us all to work together. If, for example, there's a statutory change that's needed, you as the standing committee can adopt that statutory change. So that's another reason that we're going to work together. A third thing that we're supposed to look at, and there's a publication from the Division of Legislative Finance, Representative Thompson passed a bill a number of years ago on what are called indirect expenditures. It's a weird name. Indirect expenditures are basically revenue the state could have generated, but we didn't. So an example would be, though it's not a Hess issue, would be oil tax credits. It's revenue we could have generated for production taxes, but we've foregone that revenue. That's an independent expenditure. It's the best example I can think of. And you'll see in the independent expenditure study that that Representative Thompson had commissioned, you'll see what the Hess independent expenditures are, to see if there's anything in there that gives you an idea about money that we're missing out on that maybe we shouldn't. So as I said before, at closeout, we'll allow amendments. We'll try and do the amendments as formally as possible. At the end, I will prepare a report, as we have done in the past, the subcommittee chair has done in the past, sort of summarizing the work and the recommendations of the subcommittee. But I will also forward the amendments that do not pass, because I think that's important for members of the Finance Committee to know about, and they might just decide they want to run with one of those. Let me just go see what I have missed, and I'll take a couple of questions, but then I'd like to get into the Department of Health and Human Services first presentation. Yeah, Representative Johnson.
I maybe didn't hear correctly. So all amendments will go forward to the Finance Committee. So are we voting on them or not voting on them?
Thank you. Representative Johnson, and also if people would just direct the questions through the chair, it's not a problem at this point. We'll try and keep things informal. We will vote on amendments. And the ones that pass will be recommendations of the subcommittee to the Finance Committee. The ones that fail, I think they also have the right to see in case they think there was a good idea there that we didn't think was a good idea. So they will be forwarded and they will be voted on. See if I forgot anything else. There are alternates that are available, so both for the minority and the majority. As we have noted, Representative Sadler is an alternate on the committee as well. And and I think we're ready to go. So today we're going to hear an overview from the Department of Health and Social Services. They have a number of staff members here. I'm going to let the commissioner introduce the staff members. If you direct all questions through the chair, we'll end up not interrupting each other, and we'll keep this from being conversational and make it more of a committee process. And with that, I would welcome Commissioner Davidson up to the podium to introduce her members. And Commissioner Davidson, are you able to identify the folks who are online, or do you want me to do that? Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Brianna. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nukhagalak Amitlamaghanan Valerie Davidson, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. With me today, sitting at the table, is Acting Assistant Commissioner Shonda O'Brien, who has been with the department for many years. Also in the room are Deputy Commissioner John Sherwood, if he would wave, Deputy Commissioner Karen Forrest, Dr. Jay Butler, our Chief Medical Officer, Monique Martin, our Healthcare Policy Advisor, and also we have our 8 division directors are available either in the room or on the phone, and they are Director Vicki Wilson of the Pioneer Homes, Director Randall Burns from Behavioral Health, Director Margaret Brody, Healthcare Services. I apologize, Director Burns and Director Brody are both on the phone, as is Director Rob Wood from Juvenile Justice. Director Christy Lawton from the Office of Children's Services is also on the phone. Acting Director of Public Assistance, Monica Windham, is here in the room. Dr. Jay Butler, who also does double duty as the Director of Public Health, is here in the room, as is Director Dwayne Mays from the Division of Senior and Disability Services.
Thank you. Commissioner, one thing I forgot, if you wouldn't mind. This committee is also going to be helped by Amanda Ryder from the Division of Legislative Finance. For those who are new, the Division of Legislative Finance is very much like our research department. They're nonpartisan. They're here to help everybody. When I first started, I did not use them as much. I thought only the Finance Committee members were allowed to use them. You're all allowed to use them. So Amanda has a wealth of experience that she brings. Amanda just raised her hand for 1 second. Can you raise it again, Amanda? Thanks. And I think that's it. Yeah. Commissioner, if you would just go ahead with the presentation, that would be great. I'm going to take questions during the presentation. If the questions start slowing the committee down too much, I'll probably ask folks to wait until the end, but I prefer to take them during the presentation if we can keep them short, though, and try and not be argumentative if possible, and then we can get through this more quickly but informatively. Thank you.
Brianna, Mr. Chair. The Department of Health and Social Services was originally established in 1919 as the Territorial Health Department, and upon statehood in 1949, our responsibilities were expanded to provide for the promotion and protection of public health as well as public welfare. and those are outlined in Alaska's Constitution at Article 7, Sections 5 and 6. The first link that's listed on this slide, slide number 2, are the department's homepage as well as resource links that are helpful. The second link is to the constitutional authority for the department, again, Article 7, Sections 4 and 5. The third link is the statutory authority for the duties of the department, and those are found in Title 47. The fourth link is our FY18 proposed budget. The next five slides have been prepared by Legislative Finance, and Acting Assistant Commissioner O'Brien will present these highlights.
For the record, my name is Shonda O'Brien. I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner for Health and Social Services. The first slide you see represents the total general funds for the department. You'll notice that our general fund spending has gone up steadily over the past 10 years. But starting in 2015, we've started to see reductions in our overall UGF spending. Our reductions reflected here starting in 15 equal $190 million. The next slide is number 4. The information you see here is how our funds, all the fund sources for the entire department spread across our lines of authority. And so from here you'll see that largely the funding that we have is in our grants and benefits line. And as the timeline progresses, you'll see that as our UGF funding has declined, our services have maintained and stayed at the same levels, largely due to the increase in federal authority. Slide 5 is our UGF funding spread across our divisions. The largest body of expenditures.
For a second. Mm-hmm. So I didn't when I first started. Does everybody on the committee who's not on the Finance Committee know the difference between UGF and DGF, or should we? Okay, we're all okay on that?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. These slides are often called a 10-year look back to show the progression of, for a 10-year time period, so from 2008 until 2018.
Sure. So this slide is a representation of how our general fund dollars in total spread across all of our divisions. As I was saying, our Medicaid services expenditures make up the majority of our budget. And right now, they total about 64% of our overall budget. On this slide, starting in fiscal year 10, you'll see that our UGF spending dipped down in Medicaid services. That's a representation of some funding opportunities provided by ERA. And then we saw a pretty large increase in expenditures starting in fiscal year 11 due to overall growth in the Medicaid program. And then our UGF dollars started to decline again in fiscal year 15 through the current year. Slide 6 is a representation of all funds spread across each of our divisions. Again, Medicaid services is the largest body of expenditures here. And again, you'll notice that as our spending in UGF has decreased, we've been maintaining service levels in Medicaid services through our maximization of federal funding. Since 2015, the Medicaid program has reduced general fund spending by $112 million and increased federal authority by $198 million. In slide 7, we have our total funding spread across all of the different funding sources across the department. And this slide will show kind of a breakout of where our general fund spending and our federal funds leveled out. And so you'll see that the general funds have decreased over time, but we've maintained our service levels through our federal funding opportunities. It's also important to note that these services are critical safety net programs, and so it's important to note that we've been able to maintain all of those services.
Shauna, can I interrupt for a second?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Can you go back to the last chart that had the Medicaid sort of spikes and dips, costs for Medicaid?
Mm-hmm.
And unless, and what page was that?
Slide five.
Six for us and five for them.
Slide five is just the GF. Are you looking at all fund sources?
You're right, slide five.
Okay.
Commissioner Ms. O'Brien, let me ask you this. We've had a chart in the Finance Committee over the last few years, and as we've dealt with the budget deficit, and in the past when we saw the Medicaid budget going up, the questions came, why is the Medicaid budget going up? And the answer back then, but tell me if I'm wrong, the answer back then was, in good times when fewer people are on Medicaid, that helps with the budget. In bad times when more people end up on Medicaid, that hurts the budget, but that also on an annual basis we have maybe still the highest average annual increase in medical costs in the country, or second highest. So you have a combination when in bad times of increasing numbers of people on Medicaid and an annual increase in medical costs that are the highest or second highest in the country. Is that accurate at all? Is that close to accurate? And you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, that's correct. Generally, when economies are doing well in states, fewer people are unemployed, fewer people are eligible for Medicaid. However, when states, and certainly Alaska is no exception, when states begin to experience economic downturns, we see a rise in the number of folks in that state who are eligible for services. Because Medicaid is a federal entitlement program, if they are eligible for our programs and they apply, we must serve them. The other thing that happens is, in our state, you're right, the cost of health care is the highest in the country for a number of reasons, and I know that starting this later in the session or maybe over the interim, I know that OMB Director Pat Pitney, the Department of Health and Social Services, and the Department of Administration, who are all really, quite frankly, the big spenders in our state in Medicaid, in health services, not only in Medicaid, but also purchasing insurance for state employees, political subdivisions, et cetera, and retirees, are planning to convene work sessions where we talk about what are the drivers of the increase in health care costs. But specific to the Medicaid program, one of the things that we see is the cost of help providing health care. Certainly Medicaid is not immune to the rising costs of health care in our state. And the other is, as our population ages, our cost of health care increases. Generally, young folks don't need as many services, but folks, as we age, we need a more acute level of services as well. So all of those things combine to really increase the cost of administering our program. The one exception, if I can explain, this dip that you see in 2009, that was, as Acting Assistant Commissioner O'Brien, and that's a mouthful, said, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or ERA, provided a little bit of a boost to states when nationally we were having a recession. There was an effort by the federal government to provide a little bit a boost to states by increasing the federal match so that states had to pay less. And then you can see as that increased FMAP, or federal matching assistant percentage, went away, those costs again began to increase.
Thank you. Commissioner, we have a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a little more detail on why it is that the state of Alaska has the highest dollar amount for Medicaid?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, One, Medicaid, the way that we pay for our Medicaid in our state is based upon, we have set Medicaid rates. So if you're looking at the cost of health care in Alaska, generally the best payer is private health insurance. They reimburse the best. Medicaid is probably second, third is Medicare, and then private pay. If someone can pay private pay, then perhaps that would be, they generally get written off to some percentage. But Medicaid, the way that we set our rates in Alaska, is based upon, to some degree, what impacts our budget is utilization. So how often are folks seeking out certain services? One of the things that we have done over the last couple of years, especially intensely over the last year, is we're looking at overutilization of services that occur in an inappropriate place. Here's an example. The one place that everyone in the United States can go where they legally cannot turn you away for health services is the emergency room of a hospital because of EMTALA. Federal law that requires every emergency department to stabilize a patient who shows up at their door before either releasing them on their own or transferring them to another more appropriate setting. So we had a program that was a voluntary program that were in I think the odd name is super utilizers, but really they're over utilizers of the emergency department. And we undertook a voluntary program within the Division of Healthcare Services, who manages the Medicaid program, to really match them up with a care coordinator who really worked with them over the phone, very, very low impact that first year, doing things like calling them and saying, well, I'll pretend it's me. You know, Valerie, I noticed that in the last 5 days you've been to the emergency room 5 times. I want to invite you to participate in this program so that we can find you a more appropriate setting to make sure that you're getting the care that you need. We'd like to hook you up with a primary care provider. In fact, we have set up an appointment for you on Tuesday. Will that work for you? And at first when the program started, we thought the reaction we would get is, you know, how dare you look into my medical history, et cetera, et cetera. And what we actually found is that people were so appreciative that somebody cared about the outcome of their health. And so as this plays along, on Monday, somebody would call, and again, I'm pretending, somebody would call me on Monday and say, I want to remind you, Valerie, you have an appointment tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Does that still work for you? Do we need to reschedule? Do you have a ride, etc.? And really work on a plan to be able to get that person better care. So in the first year that we implemented that program, it was a voluntary program, and we are now, as a part of Senate Bill 74, the Medicaid redesign bipartisan legislation passed by the legislature last year, we are implementing a mandatory program. And there's also another program that is a private-public partnership between the state and ASHNA, the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association.
Very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative. I committed a committee chair sin by taking you back 4 pages. Does anybody have any questions before we let them go back to where they were?
Representative
Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner Davidson. And just I want to have a comment on that very point, because, of course, I feel some responsibility. It was in my area where there were a number of those super utilizers. But, for example, just for committee members, one of the issues identified was that people using the emergency room because it was off the bus route. And so, you know, transportation being a real limiting factor there. And so now, you know, we have actually a new facility in Mountain View, and that's going to make a huge difference. But what my question was, just the way Representative Sullivan Leonard situated that, I thought I heard her say why we have the most expensive Medicaid program. And I just wanted to make sure, you know, that was a correct characterization. It's significant expense, but are we really the most expensive, or did I mishear the way that was asked? I just wanted to make sure I understood that.
Okay. Well, maybe I mischaracterized it. I was trying to reflect from what she had stated.
So, through the chair, Commissioner, so there's the discussion. We do have the highest or second highest medical costs in the country. Representative Leonard now raised the question, do we have the highest Medicaid costs because you don't necessarily pay market rate, right?
Through the chair, Representative, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Sorry. Mr. Chairman, our Medicaid expenditures are higher in many categories. There are some programs, though, if I can talk a little bit about some of the optional services. There are some services that we do provide as a part of our Medicaid program that are considered optional services that our state participates more in than some of the mandatory services. Let me back up. I think I didn't do a good job of introducing that. So under the Medicaid program, Medicaid is a federal program that is administered both by the federal government and the states. Every state has what is called a federal medical assistance percentage, or FMAP, and it's basically the federal match. And in a nutshell, the match is determined based upon the average income of the citizen of that state. So Alaska's generally our FMAP percentage, or our federal match, is 50%. There are exceptions. We have a higher match for children. We have a higher match for pregnant women who have a higher match due to the fact that they're pregnant with those children. We also have a higher match for Medicaid expansion. Medicaid under the federal program requires certain programs that are considered mandatory programs. Those are, in the general, those include inpatient visits. Those include outpatient visits. I could go on and on and on with the list, but I won't. In addition to those mandatory benefits that we that every state must provide, there are also services that are provided at a state's option. And the way that Alaska, so we're not required by federal law to provide those services. But in Alaska, we have chosen to implement those optional services as a state because they save us money in the long run. Here's an example. Medicaid pharmaceutical services or your prescriptions are not considered a mandatory service. They are considered an optional service. The reason we provide that as an optional benefit to our Medicaid beneficiaries in Alaska is because it saves money in the long run. If you have a Medicaid beneficiary who's on high blood pressure medication, or poor people generally don't have the money to spend on pharmaceuticals out of pocket, and many of those drugs, even the drugs that are generic drugs, are simply out of their reach, and so it doesn't take very many patients. In our state like ours that is largely very geographically dispersed to have, you know, you can have 10 people who have a heart attack or who have a stroke who have to be medevaced in from a community to Anchorage to be able to get that acute level of care, that ICU stay, that inpatient stay, that is a mandatory covered service. So in the end, we choose to provide that optional benefit because we save money by not paying for that emergency care when that doesn't happen. Another example is our biggest expenditure is for long-term care and support services. So on the mandatory side, a nursing level of care is a required mandatory service. So basically inpatient assisted living, skilled nursing facility, very high cost. A state has the option to cover home and community-based services as at the state's option, an optional service. Those include activities like basically help with activities of daily living that allow people to live independently in their own home. So chore services, assistance with using the restroom, helping cooking meals, etc. And even though we have that service as an option, in order to qualify for that Medicaid home and community-based waiver service, you have to meet the level of service needed for an inpatient nursing level of care. So if we didn't offer this optional service, we would basically have to cover that service in a residential inpatient facility, which creates two problems. One, it's a lot more expensive, and two, where would all of those folks go? Because we don't have enough inpatient beds in our state to be able to provide that as an inpatient service.
Thank you, Commissioner. And just for the committee's knowledge, your staff will be available to committee members outside of this committee room also if they have questions. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any other questions before we let them get back to the page they were on before?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it might be beneficial for the subcommittee to know that you had asked earlier in finance for a list of those optional programs and the state dollar amounts that could be distributed to the members of the subcommittee.
Through the chair, so Representative Tilton, you'd like a list of the optional programs?
A list of the optional programs and the state dollars that are attached to those.
Commissioner, is that something that you could provide to the subcommittee?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is.
Thank you. And when we receive that, we'll distribute that to the members of the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you would go back to the many pages ahead where you were before I took you down this rabbit trail, that would be great.
So I think we were finishing up with slide number 7. Basically, we were just pointing out that while we've been successful in decreasing our general fund spending, we have increased our federal authority and maintained services at the same levels that we've been historically spending at.
So starting at slide 8, the next 12 slides include 99 rows of detail and 12 columns that were prepared at the House Finance Committee's direction. You can see in column 1, and I apologize, the print is small.
Yeah, we actually can't see it, but we'll take your word for it.
Okay.
I can still see it. For 5 more minutes.
So in column 1, we just numbered them 1 through 99 because it was really hard to keep just in our own minds what that, to keep track of the rows. Column 2 is the budget allocation or the name of the program. Column 3, if you move across left to right, is the funding breakdown, and it includes everything from total funds, undesignated general funds, or UGF, DGF, or designated general funds, federal funds, or other. The next column is the number of employees that are in that particular program or allocation. The next column is the number of Alaskans that are served. The next column to the right is the percent of cost of that program that is covered by fees. The next column is the rating of importance to the mission using criteria provided by the committee, by the House Finance Committee. A critical rating is one that is directly accomplishing the department's constitutional or statutory mission statement. A rating of important is it may not directly relate to core services, but perhaps provides indirect supports and services that would need to be reassigned if that program did not exist. A beneficial rating enhances and supports the core services or provides beneficial and efficient services to a wide range of Alaskans, but could be removed without direct impact to the core services. And the rating of status quo, it means it has been historically funded or has been funded because of a statutory requirement but has no real effect on core services or potentially hampers agency funding. And let me just say those were quite some tongue twisters in there.
Sure. Commissioner, if you would hold on for a second. Representative Sullivan Leonard has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair. I haven't had a chance to look at this type of a PowerPoint piece, and I was wondering, how do you come upon the rating system with regard to the importance of this particular line item, and then how then do you do a rate of effectiveness with that?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, the rating of importance was prescribed to us by the House Finance Committee, and those were the in their budget memo and their directions to us. And so Let me just take you to line 3, for example. That rating says critical, and per the Finance Committee's instruction, critical means it is directly accomplishing the department's constitutional or statutory mission statement.
Okay. Through the chair, if I may follow up.
Yes, follow
so
up.
So you didn't do the rating on this then, the House Finance did, and that was by the chairmanship or the committee as a whole?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I'm sorry, the House Finance Committee provided these guidelines, and then we internally and the department used our best assessment of how that program would fit within that rating category.
Very
I'm sorry if that was
thank
confusing.
You.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Commissioner. And just for the members' knowledge, the chair of the operating budget, Representative Seaton, has included a memo at tab 1, which is what he thinks are the most important things for us to look at as members. You can decide whether you agree. But that's how he would like the subcommittee to run. So, and that's one of the things that Representative Seaton had asked for was those ratings. Go ahead, Commissioner. We've got a question from Representative Johnston.
I'm still kind of I'm confused on the rating of effectiveness. You've got 1, 2s. Could you describe what that is? That on your targets? Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, that's where I was going next, and that is in column 8, the rating of effectiveness. We used a scale of 1 to 3, and here's how we categorize those. A rating of 1, if you see a 1 in that column, to us that meant we're getting the job done. A rating of 2 is we're getting the job done, but we see substantial opportunity for improvement. A rating of 3 is we're not getting the job done, and we really see limited opportunity for improvement.
Through the chair.
Sure. Follow up.
So are you using your performance measures as your criteria for this?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes, we are. We also looked at as we were let me just give you an example. I think later on we're going to get to one that is a rating of 2, and that one is, for example, in the Office of Children's Services, while we thought they are getting the job done, but we see substantial opportunity for improvement because, quite frankly, we are not funded to the level adequately to be able to meet the level of service that we need to provide children and their families. So we're using both. So on the one hand, as we went through on this first blush, it was like, and I'll be honest, in the previous column, it was hard to go through this exercise and not call them all critical, because again, we provide critical safety net programs to children and families. But going back and judging by the criteria that was provided by the committee, I can assure you that we had, in some cases, exciting and vigorous debate within the department about where that rating should land. And so, but as Representative Sullivan Leonard said, as you are seeing this rating system for the first time, we are as well. This is a brand new matrix that, to my knowledge, hasn't been used before. So we're learning a little bit as we go along as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. You can move on, Commissioner.
Okay. And then,
actually, Commissioner, can I ask you, so in the Finance Committee, you gave your overview of these 99 lines in 20 minutes. And then I could see also the overview of these 99 lines taking like half a day. So what is your intention with the 99 lines worth of information? Right, the 99 items of.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess I could see these 99 lines taking 99 days, just to provide another perspective. But I think as we go through, we looked at several things. When we presented information to the full Finance Committee, we did the division overview, and then we also did the largest number of employees, and then we also did the largest general fund, just as a starting point. And obviously, we're happy to entertain more questions.
Thank you. Commissioner, we will Obviously, the House Finance Committee gave you like 20 minutes. We're going to try and adjourn at 5 o'clock, give or take a few minutes, and I'll just let you go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you. I will be a lot more brief from here on out.
I don't think you've done anything wrong, Commissioner. It's a lot of information.
The last three columns are outline whether it's a state or federal statutory requirement, and also on the column on the also shows whether it's a constitutional requirement as well. When you see a gray horizontal row, as we do here in row one and two, those are summaries. And all of that detail is found below, and so not all of the boxes are filled in. So, for example, in line one, I'm going to look at this. My eyes are old. In row one, which is gray, you'll see the row number on the far left-hand side. Department-wide, our Department of Health and Social Services has total funding of requested funding of $2.7 billion, of which about $1 billion is in undesignated general fund. $97 million is in designated general funds. $1.46 or almost $1.5 is in federal funds. And $101 million is in other funds. And as Acting Assistant Commissioner O'Brien mentioned earlier, we have really spent a lot of the last several budget years looking at maximizing our federal participation through refinancing efforts, through partnerships with folks who have the opportunity to help us to be able to enhance our federal match so that we can continue to provide services that will save the state general fund. So moving to the right, we serve all Alaskans. And we have a total number of employees of 3,492. We serve all Alaskans. 2.64% of this total cost, 64% of this total cost is recovered through fees. And again, our constitutional requirement is included in Article 7, Sections 4 and 5 of the Constitution. And in the far right-hand column, you can see our statutory authority is generally found in Title 47. And after this one, I'm going to smile to my friend here on my right to walk us through some of these others.
Okay. So we're going to stay with this page and just continue on with the Pioneer Homes. As you can see from the slide or from your printed page, the Pioneer Homes, majority of their staffing are actually in the homes providing direct services. The Pioneer Homes make up 2.3% of the department's overall budget.
So we thought it would be helpful to include information that isn't on this matrix to just give you a sense of what has happened since fiscal year 15. Since fiscal year 15, the Alaska Pioneer Homes budget has been reduced in UGF by 9.8% or $3.6 million. And the total full-time position reductions during that time period has been 4% or a reduction of 23 positions.
Moving on to slide 9, this is our behavioral health division. Behavioral health makes up 4.9% of our overall budget. The majority of staff in the behavioral health division are in API, and they provide direct services to the persons residing in the home or the facility at that time. Row 6 of the slide is a representation of the treatment and recovery grants. This is where the largest amount of undesignated general funds is for this division. You'll You'll see that there aren't any staff associated to that number. The staff are really spread out throughout the division, and these funds really go out to our grantees, and they're issued in the way of grant payments that provide direct services to persons with substance use disorders and things of that nature. These funds actually go out to provide services to 16 residential treatment facilities and 19 outpatient treatment providers. With Medicaid expansion, we have also been able to extend services beyond to allow providers to bill Medicaid for their clients that are eligible for Medicaid. So this has decreased their reliance on state-funded grant programs.
And Ms. O'Brien, just for the committee, we will have a separate hearing as we go on treatment services, where we can get more into detail mm-hmm. on that, mm-hmm. On Medicaid expansion, on children's services so far, on the issue of possibly privatizing the pharmaceutical function at the Pioneer Home, and others as we come up. But definitely treatment services will be a fuller presentation. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, because of that transition through expansion, in the column, the percent cost through fees, so that's not going to be reflected in that column. That's going to show up in the Medicaid. So, okay. Right. But we could think of it, and pardon me through the chair, that, you know, it's reflected in a different way, but essentially that represents, you know, some percentage of those costs are, you know, being covered in a different way now, rather than just going out through grants.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, yes, you're correct. Those costs will then be reflected in the Medicaid budget.
Okay, thank
mm-hmm. you. For the Division of Behavioral Health, still on this slide, but again, not in this matrix, since fiscal year 2005, the Division of Behavioral Health has seen a 24% cut, or $18.96 million reduction. The total full-time position reductions have been 1.4% or 5 positions. And again, a large part of that is due to Medicaid expansion.
Mr. Chair?
Sure. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Just a real quick question, if I could, through the chair. Commissioner, could you just clarify a little bit when you talk about reduction of positions? You did on the previous slide of, I believe, 23 positions, and then you said 5 here. Are these like true pink slips, or are they being absorbed somewhere else, or are they open positions that weren't filled?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, yes, those are actual elimination of positions.
Real people?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Slide 10 is our Office of Children's Services. The OCS budget makes up 5.6% of the overall budget for the department. Row 18 is a reflection of our frontline social worker component. This is where the majority of our staff are funded. These are staff that provide direct services to children and their families. Rows 20 through 23 are where we spend a lot of our UGF dollars on formula programs for foster care, adoption, and guardianship payments.
And the Office of Children's Services since fiscal year 2015 has seen a 7.3% reduction, or $6.8 million reduction. And the total number of positions, however, increase since 2005 has been 4.7%, or 24 positions, largely due to the number of children in out-of-home placements.
Through the Commissioner, is my estimate correct? Over the last 6 or 7 years, the number of youth in foster care has gone up from about 1,800 to roughly 3,000 today. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And would you contend that the number of staff have gone up commensurately with the caseload, or not as much as the caseload?
Mr. Chair, I would commend that I would. My assessment is that the number of staff have not increased commensurate with the increase in caseload.
And then we will have a fuller hearing on the Office of Children's Services. We okay? Okay, go ahead, Commissioner.
slide 11 or page 11 if you're following in your printed document is the healthcare services division. Healthcare services makes up 0.8% of the overall budget for the department. These are staff in the agency who are responsible for administering the Medicaid claims payment programs and for the Medicaid redesign work as outlined in SB 74. The staff are listed on row 28 in the medical assistance administration component. Row 25 is our catastrophic coverage. Of importance here is that we used to serve over 400 people with this program, and with Medicaid expansion and reform efforts, we are now serving less than 10 folks under this program because they're all eligible for Medicaid expansion now.
Representative Johnson.
Through the chair, are we going to have a hearing specifically on this as far as the I finished the SB 74 report, and I see that a lot hasn't been done yet, and so I feel that we need to have a handle for next year's budget on what can be accomplished in 2018 and what has been accomplished.
Representative Johnson, are you asking then for some information on really where we are in SB 74 and the reform efforts in there?
Right, and what we can look forward to as far as 2018 budgets, revisions, and how it will relate to our decisions on the budget.
Yes. Representative Johnson, I think it's a fair question, and if we forget at some point, please remind me. And Commissioner, you heard what Representative Johnson would like to hear. So.
Yes. Mr. Chair, through the Chair, Representative Johnson, you're right, Senate Bill 74 is a comprehensive Medicaid redesign bill, and I think there's a special committee meeting on reform and expansion. We believe those two go hand in hand. We have met all of our statutory requirements in terms of timelines, and we'll be happy to provide more budget detail. Lots of extensive, incredible bipartisan work that happened to be able to get us to this point. And now we're at the implementation phase. A lot of our work so far has really been in planning to make sure as we implement that we have providers who are with us so they don't disenroll, quite frankly, from being Medicaid providers, because we need providers to move with us.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Representative Johnson, because I forgot, actually that's going to be the next meeting. So it's going to be Medicaid expansion and reform. I somehow thought it was just going to be Medicaid expansion, but it'll be both. They go hand in hand, as the Commissioner said.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
And then with this particular division, healthcare services, since fiscal year 2005, they've experienced a 17.5% reduction, or a reduction of $1.7 million. Position reduction of 2.4%, or three positions since 2015. And again, these are all the folks who are really doing a lot of the heavy lifting on the analysis and the opportunities available in Senate Bill 74.
Slide number 12 is our Division of Juvenile Justice. Juvenile Justice makes up 2.1% of the overall budget. Rows 31 through 39 reflect where the employees in this division reside. They're all providing direct services in one of our facilities or in probation services. Of importance with our Division of Juvenile Justice, it's important to note that we did close our Ketchikan facility this year, and that the Nome Youth Facility is due to close in FY18 due to loss of one-time funding.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. the Nome Youth Facility, I know in Senate Bill 74 there was discussion of researching privatization of other youth facilities, and so the one-year funding was like a backstop for that. And so was that due to the recommendations finding that, you know, closing that facility would be without, you know, unintended consequences, or is that reflective of our current budget scenario and, you know, basically the need to, you know, find ways to lower costs?
through the chair, Representative Tarr, the DJ Division of Juvenile Justice privatization study will actually be released on Friday. Okay. And so we will be happy to come back and provide more detail on the outcome of that privatization study. There was also a privatization study required under Senate Bill 74 for the Alaska Pioneer Homes, mm-hmm. Specifically about pharmaceutical services, as well as a privatization study on Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And those reports are all will all be released on Friday.
And so, Mr. Chairman, just as a follow-up, and so the decision on this Nome facility, and my concern is just the safety of kids and being them having to be so far away from their home communities and, you know, sort of the beneficial therapeutic outcomes that can have, you know, from having your support network nearby. And so, you know, now I guess is this sort of where we're past the point of no return on this facility, and where I'm trying to remember where kids will be located now otherwise.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, when the governor released this proposed budget, those feasibility studies had not been completed.
Okay.
As we were looking at taking our budget cuts, just like every other department has done, a recommendation that we made to the governor at the time was, since the Nome Youth Facility was only provided with 1 year funding, mm-hmm. In the budget process last year, we did not renew that that for an additional year. You know, clearly we will be looking at, along with the legislature, we'll be looking at the privatization studies when they come out, because for all of the same questions and issues that you raised in your question.
Thank you.
So with regard to juvenile justice, since fiscal year 2015, they have sustained a 7% budget cut, or $4 million, and full-time position reductions of 7.9%, or 38 positions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Commissioner, would you be able to provide us with the summary that you're reading from with regard to the reductions and the effect on your department and all Alaskans? That would help me for follow-up work on this, if that would be okay.
Representative Leonard, I don't feel comfortable telling a commissioner to share her notes with any of us, if that's their request. It's certainly up to the commissioner if you'd like to, but I'm not going to ask her to do that.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I thought what I heard you ask is to share the dollar reductions and the percent reductions and the number of reductions of staff and the percentage reductions. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, it is.
Okay.
I just want to be as well informed as the rest of the committee on your projections here. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard. I misunderstood the question. So yeah.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry. I should have provided that information. We were, quite frankly, we were strictly adhering to the instructions that we had received from the committee at large. And obviously, providing that level of budget detail has certainly been helpful to me, and equally will be helpful to you. And we'll be happy to provide that detail. So next, the Division of Public Assistance on slide 13.
The Division of Public Assistance budget is actually slides 13 and 14. Public assistance makes up 11.2% of the overall budget for the department. In row 53 on page 13, you'll see that the majority of the staff in this division are in field services. Field services staff are responsible for determining eligibility and working through the benefit process with recipients. They are directly providing services to Alaskans. In row 45, the largest amount of general fund dollars in the division is in the Adult Public Assistance Program. The Adult Public Assistance Program is the program responsible for satisfying the maintenance of effort requirement for the Medicaid program in the state of Alaska.
within the Division of Public Assistance, the change since 2015, this division has seen a 15.7% reduction, or $25.3 million reduction. The number of full-time positions since 2015 have been reduced by 1.6%. I think that number is a little bit low. I'm going to double-check this number. One of the things that happened, and we certainly know, we have received, we routinely receive calls from legislators, from certainly from the governor's office, from concerned Alaskans that they are experiencing unduly long wait times as applications are being processed, not only for Medicaid but other public assistance programs for those eligibility determinations. One of the things that happened that folks should be aware of through the budget process is in the first year that we were moving forward with Medicaid expansion, the Alaska Mental Health Trust made $1.3 million available to the Department of Health and Social Services for positions within the Division of Public Assistance. I think there might have been two positions in healthcare services to assist us with the additional around 22,000 Alaskans that we expected to apply for Medicaid expansion, which was great to be able to have that level of assistance to deal with those additional applications. Unfortunately, what also happened in that same budget year is we were reduced in the Division of Public Assistance. We received a $1.5 million reduction in positions to the Division of Public Assistance for processing those applications. So about 26 positions. So instead of being $1.3 million ahead in that year, we were actually $200,000 behind. And since those are recurring reduction in staff, we continue to be $1.5 million behind in staff who are available to be able to process those applications. So while folks are working fast and furious to try and get that backlog caught up, unfortunately, we are in a new era where Alaskans will continue to wait to experience long wait times as we are processing those applications. We do have some fast tracks for folks who need immediate assistance. In particular, women who are pregnant, we want to make sure that they get covered as quickly as possible to ensure they have a good, healthy pregnancy, get good prenatal care, and have a good, healthy baby. But otherwise, we are expecting to continue to experience delays in processing.
Slides 15 and 16 are the Division of Public Health. Public Health makes up 4.3% of the overall budget. The majority of staffing in the Division of Public Health are in the nursing component, which is in row 60. Our nurses are providing direct services. In row 70, you'll see the community health grants. This grant program has been successfully reduced. You'll see that on page 16 through refinancing opportunities under the Medicaid program. So we've been able to successfully reduce the GF portion of the program to offset those costs with Medicaid.
At 100% federal match. Because those are programs that are subject to the tribal claiming policy. Within public health, since 2015, this division has seen a 22.9% reduction, or $12.79 million, 11.9% reduction in positions, or a reduction of 57 positions.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought at one point I heard we were looking at the change from FY 2005 to 15, or was it? I may have written it down originally. So, when you're giving those comparisons, it's FY 15 to now.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr. Yes. So, as we were doing the initial five slides, we are doing a 10-year look-back period. But for these purposes, the numbers I'm providing are the change since FY15 to the governor's proposed budget. I'm sorry if that wasn't clear.
No, thank you. I wrote it down wrong, I believe. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Representative Johnston, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the community health grants, are those for community centers? Are those for rural health centers? I was confused there.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the community health grants are actually pass-through funds that we share with communities. Those are not through rural health centers. There are some funds that go to the municipality of Anchorage, for example, and those have experienced some reductions in the budget process as well.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair? Thank you. So, but you're saying that you've also had savings because there has been additional federal funding?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, in this category, there are both community health grants as well as community health aid training grants. Those funds have now been capped. The community health aid training, or CHATS grants, have been zeroed out of the UGF budget and have now been recouped in an approval from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who approved a state plan amendment that would allow us to be able to capture those costs as a part of the Medicaid program to tribal facilities who train those community health aides at 100% federal match.
So, through the chair, it was the cut, the UGF cut, is basically for the community health center grants.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Slide 17 is our Senior and Disability Services division. Senior and Disability Services makes up 2.5% of the overall budget. Row 73 on this slide is our Administrative Services Division for Senior and Disability Services. The majority of staff are located in this component throughout the division due to the size of the division. Most of the staff in that component really are providing direct services, however, so they aren't really administrative in nature.
Representative Spanholtz.
Through the chair, could you repeat the percentage of the overall budget that this
sure.
category includes?
It makes up 2.5%.
Thank you.
So many of the staff, as I was saying, in that component really are more than just administrative. They are providing direct services. A lot of the staff are protective services specialists and things of that nature. Row 75 is the community-based grants programs. And these are programs, as the commissioner had mentioned earlier, that provide services to seniors in their homes, things such as meals and transportation, low-cost services to help maximize their independence and keep them in their homes longer.
And for the Division of Senior and Disability Services, since FY 2015, they have sustained a 0.5% reduction, or $208,000. The total full-time positions has increased since 2015, 1.8%, or three employees, largely because in 2016 a program was transferred into this division for about $8.9 million. So that was the independent living program transferred from the Department of Labor to the Department of Health and Social Services. The early intervention infant learning program component was transferred from the Office of Children's Services to this division, the Division of Senior and Disability Services.
Slide 18 is our Department Support Services Division. This is, in effect, our Admin Services Division. The majority of the staff in our division is our information technology staff, and our IT manager will be transferring over to the Shared Services Division in the FY18 budget to become part of the Centralized Information Office.
and for departmental support services since 2015. This unit has received a reduction of 31.8%, or a $7.8 million reduction. The total of full-time positions reduced since 2015 is 8.5%, or 22 positions.
Our final slide is our Medicaid Services Division. This is where the majority of our Medicaid services expenditures reside. This is the budget that provides for all of those services. Rows 95, 96, 97, 98, and 99 represent the budgets for each of those specific program areas, and also demonstrate the number of Alaskans being served by those programs. It's important to note that our adult preventive dental component and the Medicaid services component does not represent the entire body of expenditures for the dental program. This is just a special spot for some of the services that are provided through adult dental.
Justin has a question.
Yes, through the chair, I noticed on 96, the children's Medicaid services, and it's been transferred over to the behavioral health medical, and I'm not clear why.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Johnston, the Children's Services Medicaid component was transferred into the behavioral health component of the Medicaid services unit because the services provided are largely behavioral health related, and so it made more sense programmatically to combine the two.
Let me ask a question. Last year, as I recall, there was the elimination of a dental program from the budget. So what dental services do we provide? Did we eliminate dental services last year? I suppose we, those who voted for the budget, I was one of them. But
the dental, optional dental services.
I would have to follow up.
Mr. Chair, there was a reduction to the optional dental services, but it was not eliminated.
Commissioner, can you just let the committee and myself know, so what dental services do we now provide through Medicaid, and what do we not provide?
Sure, we'd be happy to provide
that
list.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for these adult preventive dental Medicaid services, they're not all the services. Some of those are included in the healthcare Medicaid services line. The legislature, when we originally offered as an optional service these adult preventive dental Medicaid services in this category, asked us to account for those separately, and those are typically for dentures. And I believe the rationale at the time was, if we're looking at getting Alaskans to sustainability, if you show up for a job interview when you're missing some teeth or you have no teeth, it's pretty hard to get a job. So,
Commissioner, we maintained that program intact?
To some degree, yes, we have, but there are reductions in terms of utilization, but we'd be happy to provide that detail.
Thank you. All right, go ahead.
Reductions in the Medicaid services division or components that reside here. I had mentioned earlier we've received $112 million in reductions to our general fund, but we've also increased our federal authorization by $198 million. So service levels have been maintained while we've been successful in reducing our UGF.
And Mr. Chair, that takes us through row 99.
Thank you very much. Do members have any questions? Yeah, Representative Spahnholz.
Through the chair, just another repetition. You increased federal receipts in Medicaid services by $198 million. How much did we decrease UGF by? Was it 112?
Through the chair, Representative Spahnholz, that was $112 million.
thank you.
And the percentage breakdown for that is, I believe, 3% was the reduction overall for the entire funding, for all funding sources, and 8% was the reduction overall for UGF.
Representative Johnston.
And we don't need this today, but I'm interested in the savings through tribal health and then the cost to Medicaid of tribal health. Does that make sense? If there's any cost with Medicaid expansion that has been applied to tribal health, but then also what savings we have received through Medicaid expansion that is applied to tribal health.
Commissioner, do you understand the question,
would you like it repeated?
I think not quite. I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Johnson, if you could restate it another way.
Sorry. So my question is, with Medicaid expansion, have some of those funds gone to tribal health organizations? That's number one. And then because of Medicaid expansion and tribal health, what has been the savings to the state?
Thank you.
Does that make sense?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes, I think I understand the question. So for the first part of the question, any Medicaid provider enrollee who has provided a medically necessary service under Medicaid, whether it's Medicaid or expansion, can seek reimbursement from our Medicaid program for those services, including tribal health and non-tribal health programs. Over the last year, we have been engaged in some pretty extensive and intense negotiations between tribal organizations and non-tribal organizations since the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services implemented a new, provided new guidance on what they call the tribal claiming policy. And I'm going to try and explain this without delving deep into a three-hour exciting talk about this stuff, so let me do my best. So the way that it used to work is, for a long time, the federal government has required tribal health organizations to seek third-party reimbursement, private insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, etc. And so tribal organizations who provide services must seek reimbursement from Medicaid. The way that, since it is, though, a federal trust responsibility, the federal government has implemented a rule that if three things come together, it's 100% federal. If you're an IHS beneficiary, an Alaska Native or American Indian like me, if you are also a Medicaid beneficiary, let's pretend I am, and I receive my care through an IHS facility, including tribally operated facilities in Alaska, then the federal government considered that to be a federal responsibility and reimbursed at 100% of that cost. So no normal 50-50 state match, 100% of the cost. The way that they have interpreted that historically has been very narrow. It must be within the four walls of the facility, and once you cross that threshold, you revert back to 50% or whatever the appropriate percentage was for that category of eligible Medicaid beneficiary. With the change in the tribal claiming policy, Governor Walker made the request of former Secretary Burwell that we would like to also extend that federal trust responsibility for medically necessary travel, that really it's an access to care issue, and so travel should be considered 100% for those beneficiaries. And we also made the request that if care started in an IHS facility but was referred to a non-tribal facility because they didn't have the capacity to care to provide that care, that should also be considered at 100%. So, for example, I'll be the example again. Let's say I am in Bethel. I have an issue, and I go to my facility, the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation, who provides my health care, IHS facility, and they say, "Oh my gosh, Val, you've just had a heart attack," and they They then send me, medevac me in to Alaska Native Medical Center. Alaska Native Medical Center gets me, and they say, oh my gosh, Val, your condition is so terrible that we cannot provide this acute level of care. You need a specialized ultra super duper cardiologist, and we're going to send you to Alaska Regional or Providence. It used to be once that transfer was made from ANMC to Providence or Alaska Regional or another facility, that 100% federal match went away. What CMS has agreed, though, is so long as we have a coordinated care agreement between the tribal referring facility and the non-tribal receiving facility, they will, and you satisfy certain conditions, they will consider that also to be 100% federal match. So our opportunities for better partnership, for expanding the level of care that's available to Alaskans by negotiating these agreements between tribal and non-tribal facilities, really allows us to extend the level of care available, allows us to not duplicate services, and also allows us to save general fund dollars. And so it's in a little bit odd situation because we are not parties to those agreements. So in one sense, we're like a dating service or a marriage broker, or I'm not sure what else to describe it, how else to describe it, but those negotiations are ongoing, and it has been an exciting time, but we're still working through those.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Commissioner Representative Kito has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for being here, Commissioner Davidson, mm-hmm. and Ms. O'Brien. So my question really is, one of the comments that has been made by people is we need to cut some of the larger programs, Medicaid being one, of course, the standard Medicaid, not expansion, the 50% reimbursable that is about $600 million. And my curiosity is, what would happen if we tried to reduce that $600 million? Do we provide service for a portion of a year, or are there other mechanisms to try and decrease the level of service to beneficiaries?
Through the chair, Representative Kito, there are some things that we can do through utilization management, where we have been able to do that. For example, is in home and community-based waiver services by imposing limitations on the number of hours or number of units of services that Medicaid will pay for. That is not. I will confess that transition was what I would describe as exciting times for the department as well as for the beneficiaries, because when we are trying to ensure that Alaskans can safely remain in their own homes, when we reduce that level of service available to them, we might be also reducing the amount of time that will allow them to be able to stay in their own home. So it's a little bit of a struggle, and we try to get as close to right sizing as we can, but we don't always, I'll be honest, we don't always hit it just right. One of the things that we have also done as a department is really scrutinize travel. Medicaid will only pay for medically necessary travel, and that means the care is not available within your location. So if it is care that can be provided there, then Medicaid generally will not authorize travel. We also try to, if a family needs follow-up care, but all of the care, we see this sometimes in families who, thank goodness, have stepped up to provide foster care for children, to be foster parents to children who have special needs, but those services aren't available in that community. We may be able to travel them together so that the family can do one trip instead of a separate trip, because obviously those children cannot travel unattended. But I guess in a nutshell, I think a lot of times when we talk about Medicaid, we talk often about the cost to the state, but I think Medicaid also provides a tremendous benefit to Alaskans, as I know that you know. We're very fortunate in our state that we provide really good comprehensive prenatal care for low-income women, which ensures that they have a good, safe pregnancy, and so that when those babies are born, they are born healthy and don't cost us more in the long run. Medicaid also ensures that we have immunizations for children. Medicaid also provides EPSDT screenings, which are early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment service. It's a screening. It's basically, people call them your well baby checks or your well child checks at critical times in a child's development to ensure that they are meeting benchmarks for their physical development, their emotional development as we move forward, to make sure that we intervene early, because sometimes we know, all times we know, that the earlier you intervene, the faster we're able to get those children on track.
I'm going to follow up.
Sure, Representative Keto.
Thank you. I guess follow up, really, I'm just trying to understand. So if we do not provide funding for Medicaid at the level that we expect services, there is, I guess I'm getting the strong possibility we leave Alaskans without care. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, generally, in order to make yes and no, in order to make cut changes to the Medicaid program, we can either reduce eligibility, which is so maybe in some categories we reduce the federal poverty level eligibility rate so that fewer people qualify for Medicaid. So basically we kick them off the program. The other thing that we can do is we can reduce the reimbursement rates. Some folks have said that in our state, Alaska is one of the few states that where the Medicaid reimbursement is actually higher than Medicare. Some folks have said you should reduce the Medicaid reimbursement rate to providers. The challenge there is we should be careful what we ask for. If anyone who has elderly parents or relatives who are on Medicare, try finding a new provider for somebody who is enrolled in Medicare. Generally, providers won't accept that rate of reimbursement. The other is we can also reduce utilization by the methods I described earlier, by limiting duration, limiting dollar amounts, such as we're doing with adult dental. The other thing that we can do, which is what we've been trying to do most aggressively because it also yields the biggest return on investment, is really aggressively leveraging those federal resources to the extent that we can. Working with tribal health organizations and really developing those tribal and non-tribal partnerships that allow us to be able to continue the level of service, but reducing the general fund by 50% and increasing the federal participation by 50%.
Thank you.
Commissioner,
I was going to say no, thanks.
Commissioner, I know you work very hard on trying to find every single avenue you can to get higher than the roughly 50% federal match. So you described the tribal health sort of waiver that you were looking for to allow patients to be transferred to a non-tribal facility. Members, you can talk to the commissioner. There are a number of other initiatives the commissioner has sort of launched to try and increase the federal match rate over the years, and I do appreciate the work. Are there any other questions from the committee? All right. At our next meeting, Thursday, January 26th, we'll also meet at 3:30. We'll hear from the commissioner on the status of Medicaid expansion and reform. That'll deal with a lot of the questions that came up today. And I'd like to thank you for presenting today. I'd like to thank everybody who attended today. I'd like to thank the committee members who attended throughout the whole hearing today. And with that, I will turn the meeting back over to the HESC committee chair so she can run the rest of the meeting.
This is Representative Sponholz. The time is 5:02, and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.